On this week's edition of New York Now, the debate over bail reform exploded at the state capitol with Democrats now divided on the new laws.
I will be damned if you take me back 400 years with one word.
Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul visits Puerto Rico while hundreds of earthquakes continue to rock the island. She'll tell us what she saw and if the federal government should be doing more. Governor Andrew Cuomo has a new proposal that could change the lives of so-called gig workers. We'll explain. And the Reporters Roundtable is in. I'm Dan Clark, and this is New York Now.
Funding for New York Now is provided by WNET.
Today, the Senate majority will pass
a law prohibiting it, and we will take them to court challenging it.
Yet another stand for New York and sending a message to the nation.
Welcome to this week's edition of New York Now. I'm Dan Clark. All was calm at the state capitol in Albany at the start of the week, but that didn't last long. The state's new laws on cash bail quickly became the news of the week after Democrats in the state Senate proposed a series of changes to the new laws. Here's Long Island Senator Jim Gorin, a Democrat who helped write the proposal.
It maintains the core principle of criminal justice reform, which is to make sure that we don't have two sets of justice, ones who can afford and ones who cannot. But it clearly fixes some of the issues that many of us have been saying need to be corrected, so that we're simply giving judges the discretion they need so that we can protect communities and protect individuals as well.
Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie told reporters he wants to give the new law more time before considering any changes.
And also, as I said before, this law has only been in effect for 6 weeks. And I think in order to ascertain as to whether any law that is a transformational change is working, you need real data, real information, not cherry-picked stories and sensationalized events to try to paint a picture as to whether law is working or not.
Others were more direct with their thoughts on the proposal, and those comments extended to a handful of Democrats from Long Island. Those are Democrats who are largely behind the change to the new bail laws. Here's Assemblyman Walter Mosley, a Democrat from Brooklyn.
We can't be bound by five or six members who want to have us promote regressive policies. We can't be bound by five or six members that call themselves Democrats, but yet don't act like Democrats.
Lawmakers are away from Albany next week, but you can expect more news on bail reform over the next month. More on that later. But first, Governor Andrew Cuomo has a new proposal this year that could change the lives of thousands of so-called gig workers. Those are people like your Uber driver or freelance workers who have a contract with a company to get paid, but they aren't considered employees. Cuomo wants new regulations and protections for those workers, but not everyone's on board. Jessica Marshall has the story.
I guess most of my adult life has been freelancing.
Donna LaCorey is a freelance writer based in upstate New York.
I can set my own hours. I can go where I want to go. I can take breaks when I want to take breaks. And it really alleviates a lot of stress that comes with working in a traditional job. And I feel I can be as creative as I want to be.
She's one of thousands of workers that could be affected by a proposal from Governor Andrew Cuomo on so-called gig workers. Those are people who work as independent contractors primarily for an app-based company like Uber or DoorDash rather than employees. In his State of the State address in January, Cuomo vowed to explore legislation that would enhance workers' rights and protections for gig workers, who he says account for more than 40% of the state's workforce this year.
It's an economy which has spurred growth and many innovations, but it's an economy where too many workers are excluded from the progress of fair pay and independent contractors. Too many corporations are increasing their profits at the expense of the employee and the taxpayer, and that must end.
Cuomo followed that up in his budget proposal by calling for a task force to come up with recommendations for legislation. New York State AFL-CIO President Mario Cilento called the fight to ensure fairness for gig workers a top priority this year.
They should have the right to a minimum wage and overtime pay, the right to paid family leave, workers' comp, unemployment insurance, the right to organize, and be protected by any discriminatory actions taken at the workplace. Right now, they don't have those protections. It's not right, and it's not fair.
While most interested parties have gone on record as being supportive of the governor's call for a task force, the concern among some has become whether lawmakers will craft legislation that would really meet the needs of the state's gig workers and freelancers. Frank Kerbin of the Business Council of New York State says taking the wrong tactic could disrupt the business model for some app-based companies.
We're hoping that this new economy will, instead of spurring some old habits, will spur some innovative thinking by the legislature and the governor to be just as creative as these new companies were, as Uber and Lyft and Wag were, in coming up with these services. The government needs to meet that challenge and be just as innovative.
Late last year, California passed its controversial AB 5 law. It was designed to increase protections for independent contractors and freelancers working in the state. It limits a company's ability to avoid extending benefits to workers who are not considered employees. But it created a legal backlash from companies like Uber and Postmates, and it has freelancers like Donna LaCorey fearing for their careers.
AB 5 is a disaster. People are losing their livelihoods. We're hearing stories of companies just not even considering independent contractors anymore. They're not renewing contracts. And they're specifically saying, we don't want people from New York, we don't want people from New Jersey, and we don't want people from California, because they know that laws are either being considered there or have passed, like in California.
Many gig workers feel the same way. Some were at the state capitol in Albany recently to make their case to lawmakers.
My problem with that, with Uber, would be if you then become an employee of Uber instead of an independent contractor. As an employee, now they may have to set up schedules. And that's something I couldn't work with, a schedule. Especially if they wanted me to work, drive at night, which I don't like to. And it would, on days that I can't do it. That would mean I'd probably have to stop driving for Uber if it didn't work in my schedule.
So I just hope that they stand behind us and, you know, and let us continue to be great.
They're just a handful of the thousands of freelance and gig workers urging New York lawmakers to consider any legislation on the gig economy carefully.
New York has to be really careful in how they do this. Obviously, California, I mean, if this was a good law, there wouldn't be carve-outs. That's what they have in California. Certain professions are carved out. They are not, you know, they're excluded from the law, and there have been a whole bunch of lawsuits because of that. So if it was good legislation, there wouldn't be lawsuits, there wouldn't be carve-outs, it would just work, and it's not working. We need something that works.
From the state AFL-CIO's perspective, it's the Hippocratic Oath, do no harm. We don't want to bring people who are truly independent contractors into something that doesn't fit them.
State Senator Diane Savino, who chairs the State Committee on Internet and Technology, says she's confident the state will come up with effective legislation.
I mean, there's enough of us talking about it now. The AFL-CIO is engaged 110%. They really want to do something. The governor's obviously engaged. The industries are here, you know, the Tech NYC and TechNet, and then their affiliate, you know, app companies. And they all say the same thing. They want to be able to create flexible workforce that has the protections. So if we all agree on that, it shouldn't be that complicated.
As the legislative session unfolds, freelancers like Donna LaCorey say they're thinking positively.
New York has a huge creative economy, and that's really important to the identity of New York, I think. And, you know, while we were really nervous, we're really hopeful that people are listening and will do the right thing in the end.
In Albany, I'm Jessica Marshall.
Now for a look beyond New York to Puerto Rico, where hundreds of earthquakes have rocked the island for 7 weeks now. That's caused major damage on the island, which is still recovering from Hurricane Maria. Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul led a state delegation to Puerto Rico last week to help with recovery efforts. We spoke with her about what she saw and if the federal government should be doing more. Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul, thank you so much for being here on New York Now this week.
Delighted to be here, Dan, and I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Absolutely. So you led a delegation down to Puerto Rico of mental health professionals and state building inspectors. This was a two-day trip, I believe. Tell me about just generally what you saw when you went down with this coalition.
You know, you really had to see it to believe it. when you think about Puerto Rico and you get to see pictures of San Juan and everything looks like it's back to normal from the aftermath of Hurricane Maria, you don't have to go very far to still see the devastation from the hurricane that still exists 2 years later, as well as a community that took a hit, not just from a hurricane, but literally wiped out because of an earthquake. Unprecedented double attacks on this remote part of the island, small communities. And what I saw was truly heartbreaking. American citizens, and we need to remind people, these are American citizens lying on cots in the hot sun whose houses were just a pile of rubble. Little kids who've been out of school for a month and no chance of getting back because there's no school. And they're afraid to go into the existing buildings because there's been 3,000 earthquakes and aftershocks since the day the first earthquake struck in December and the second major one in January. Indeed, we had a 5.0 on the Richter scale while I was there. So I have to tell you, there is still such strong need. And the federal government has abdicated their responsibility once again. And the state of New York under Governor Cuomo is stepping up.
I want to talk about the federal government in just a bit, but first, let's talk about those mental health professionals, because for me, when I heard that you were going down to do this, that's an angle of this that I would have never even thought about, that these people have experienced this hurricane and then this earthquake, and they are feeling these emotions, but they don't have any access to services to deal with them.
And that is so true, and I'm glad you're putting the spotlight on that. I mean, that's usually the last thing you think of. They need someone to help rebuild their house. They need to get back. They need medical supplies. But the mental toll that this has taken, people who are without power, literally for 6 months, some to a year, living a subsistence level, waiting for help to come to their island, and it didn't come for a long time. We've been on the ground, but we do the best we can with resources from New York. But then to think that they're finally getting back their lives back to normal, the buildings are starting to go up, and then to have them all brought down with an earthquake, I have to tell you, I saw it in the eyes of people. And it's almost a blank look of, like, we can't take anymore. So our mental health professionals, and this is just the first wave that are going to go down, they're doing art therapy with little kids in tents who should be in school but won't be in school for literally months. And just talking about their feelings and how they're going to recover. And this young boy I met, probably a 12-year-old, just sat there with such a lost look. And I gave him a hug and I said, "You're going to be okay, honey." He goes, "Well, I lost my school. I lost my house. I don't know where my friends are. And I got my grandma here, and we're sitting out here all day long." And I thought, this is so sad. And we need to keep talking about this. It is not over by any stretch of the imagination. So these mental health professionals are performing a critical role to help continue building their resiliency. I told this little boy, I said, "Listen, you're going to be the strongest adult ever, because who else is going to be able to say, I survived a hurricane and an earthquake, and I'm still standing. It didn't take me down." We need to give them positive reinforcement, particularly the children, that they're going to be okay.
The amount of damage and just tragedy that's happened down there is monumental over the past few years. And for some people, they might not know New York's special relationship with Puerto Rico. And we've certainly given them a lot of aid over the past 2 or 3 years since Hurricane Maria. Kind of explain why we have that relationship with Puerto Rico and why we're doing so much to help.
They're part of the family. 1.1 million Puerto Ricans call New York State home. We have communities in New York City, Buffalo, Syracuse, Rochester, where many of them have moved to. We have a lot of people who now move there since the hurricane, who more have come up to New York since the earthquake. But we've had this long history. It goes back to when my father and grandfather worked in the steel plants in Lackawanna, New York. They were shoulder to shoulder with Puerto Ricans who brought their families to places like Buffalo looking for a better opportunity. Or they worked in the migrant workers working in the fields, helping our agriculture grow. So they've always been here with us. They're American citizens. And so the governor steps up when he sees that there's been a failure of leadership, like we saw from the federal government under Donald Trump with the last major crisis. And we went down there, the governor was down there within almost no time, made 5 trips to Puerto Rico, recently went there over Thanksgiving, even before the earthquake. Then he's been there since the earthquake. So that shows we show up, it's a commitment, but then we bring back new ideas.
Did they talk to you, the residents in Puerto Rico, did they talk to you at all about maybe needs that they have that just haven't been met yet, either, you know, through New York State or the federal government?
Right, and that's the one they need to get kids back in school. I heard this loud and clear. There's just children sitting out there, you know, thousands of kids for the last month who've been without a classroom. It's not safe to go in the buildings. They're in tents, everyone's displaced. I also, while I was there, there were 400 people laid off from a hospital. They're losing their income because the hospital's shut down. And they're
because
just doing,
of the damage from the
because
earthquakes.
Of the damage. The hospital is damaged. They can't go in there. So now they're setting up tents in parking lots and stadiums. And there are these camps that people have been living in. And these were not impoverished neighborhoods. These were nice middle-class homes reduced to rubble. And the problem is, if you rebuild it again, it's probably $150,000. Right. FEMA will give them $35,000. So they'll never have the life they had before, the same quality house. So I understand we need to fight with FEMA on this, get them more money. And as far as the needs I saw, it definitely goes to medical supplies, school supplies, and these tents. Let's get these kids back in school.
You were there on the ground. In terms of the federal government, what did you see there? Has there been a big response from the federal government or a satisfactory response? Should they be doing more?
Should be doing more. I mean, we did meet some FEMA personnel who were there, and certainly they get defensive because, you know, they're doing the, you know, the people on the ground for FEMA, they're good people, they're doing the best they can.
Absolutely.
But if Washington isn't sending them the resources, I mean, Congress just literally passed a major aid bill that will help Puerto Rico, but it has to get through the Senate and signed by the president. Will he take that step? You think about how long it took to get aid to that island after Hurricane Maria. It was unconscionable, the weight that people had to have. And then the president goes down and throws rolls of paper towels at people, and they're supposed to be grateful. I mean, these are proud people. I mean, they want to be respected and not treated like a photo op.
This is obviously a tragedy, but how is the morale of the people that you talk to down there? Is it encouraging for New York to be going down there for them and giving them the support, or do they seem kind of hopeless at this point?
You know, the elected officials are very grateful because they know that New York is doing more than the other states and indeed the nation. So they're grateful for that. They've all know that the governor has been there. They appreciated my visits. I think there's a sense of people that are out there that how much more can we take? And they're fearful because once you experience an earthquake, you never have a sense of security. When I was literally in the airport, the earth trembled. And it was a frightening experience, but our walls stayed up. I cannot imagine being in the environment where you watched your house crumble and then you're now supposed to go into another building the next day. You never know. People are literally sleeping. Even if your house is stable, people are sleeping in their yards at night because they're afraid of the next earthquake that's going to result in their roof collapsing on them.
All right, well, we'll be keeping an eye on that down in Puerto Rico. Thank you so much, Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul, for being on New York Now.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
All right, and now for some analysis of the week's news. We're at the Reporters Roundtable. I'm Casey Seiler from the Times Union. Happy to be joined by my friends Bernadette Hogan from the New York Post and Yancey Roy from Newsday. So the big development as we count down towards the end of budget season right now is the offering of a Senate Democratic compromise on bail reform. While the details are not all out there, Yancey, you, I believe, broke the news on this, in response to questions about the constrainment, as it were, of cash bail, this proposal would do away with cash bail entirely.
Right. The new bail law is, 6 weeks old? It's barely started running, but obviously there's public pressure all around this issue, and it's an election year. So the Senate Democrats came out with what they call a compromise proposal. It largely resembles what the federal system is. It also cobbles from New Jersey a little bit. And the big thing is elimination of cash altogether. No more cash in the equation. You wouldn't have any sort of sense of post-bail to get out. So in this system, you've either committed a crime that is serious enough for a judge to remand you to jail, subject you to some sort of electronic monitoring, or just release you on your own recognizance until your trial date. And the other part of it is the list of crimes that are subject to either jail or monitoring would be longer than what we have now, chiefly manslaughter, any kind of crime that involves a fatality or a dead body. And then there's other provisions for sex crimes, hate crimes, and more provisions for domestic violence.
Bert, did you want to add?
Right. And so, again, Yancey broke that story. And this came from a working group put together by the Senate Majority Leader, Andrea Stewart-Cousins, comprised of 8 different senators, several from Long Island and Westchester, and then some interesting names like Senator Jamal Bailey and Luis Sepulveda, who represent the more, you know, they were really pushing for the bail reform bill last year. So you had a mix of senators. However, in the assembly side, we saw some major disagreements. And shortly after this story broke and the proposal was floated, a bunch of assembly members came out saying, hell no, we are not going back on bail. We did not fight for this just to completely, you know, revert to where we were last year.
Carl Hastie said this week, in response to kind of news of this compromise coming out, we must be careful not to rush to make changes that could cause more people to be incarcerated before their trial and before they have been convicted of a crime. Basically, that giving judges discretion, although Andrew Stewart Cousins in the working group has said, no, there are going to be strict guidelines for judges, would run the risk of falling back into a system where there would be wide variation in who gets remanded, for example, in one part of New York versus in another, for example, depending upon a judge's tendencies, as it were.
Right. And look, there's a part of the disagreement is how do you define how much discretion a judge gets, right? The fear is from advocates that even if you put up guidelines that say you can only consider A, B, and C, and these things are such as criminal history, the nature of the crime, was there violence involved, that inevitably what happens is minorities end up being more often remanded to jail than white people. And so they say that's why we don't want discretion. And, you know, one of the interesting things of having been around here long enough is to see how the political left and right have kind of flip-flopped back and forth on the question of judicial discretion way back 15 years ago when the issue of the day was Rockefeller drug right. laws and the repeal of that. The call was coming from the left that these drug laws and the mandatory sentences they carried were too strict and you'd handcuff judges and we need to have judges act like judges. And lo and behold, here we are in 2020, and it's the political right that is saying, you guys have handcuffed judges. You need to let judges be judges.
Bernadette, the governor has said that he is willing to support the Senate proposal, even though not all the particulars are out yet.
Right, and the governor said that yesterday on the radio, he said, this is similar to my proposal last year. It's not the same, it's similar. But again, the governor hasn't really, you know, he's also offered very slim details regarding this because they want to see how this plays out, especially leading up to budget.
Yeah.
And as you said before, Speaker Hastie has been a hard, no, we're not going back on this. And they're going to see again how the moderate members and the more progressive left members are reacting to this.
One issue the governor has been much more outspoken on is his ongoing battle with the White House over the federal suspension, the barring of New Yorkers from so-called trusted traveler programs like Global Entry. We're talking Friday morning. On Thursday afternoon, the governor met with President Donald Trump in the White House in a meeting that was preceded by heated rhetoric on both sides, I think it's fair to say.
Right. So there's threat of a lawsuit because Global Entry, as you mentioned, is this program that allows people to easily, I suppose, travel without having to go through the rigmarole of when you're going through an airport and it takes a while, et cetera. A fast lane, exactly. So President Trump last week, or the Department of Homeland Security, rather, announced that they're going to suspend the program in New York. And this is predicated on the recently passed green light law, which allows undocumented immigrants to obtain driver's licenses. So Governor Cuomo is saying, well, this is completely politically motivated. The federal government is against us, et cetera, et cetera. So he went down to D.C. yesterday, had a meeting with President Trump, and he came away with it saying, well, we need to still talk more.
The compromise that the governor has offered was we will give DHS, Border Patrol, access to the DMV database, which is currently blocked by the green light law, for the limited purpose of vetting people who are applying for these programs.
Right. Not just unfettered access to DMV, but if you, Casey, apply for it, then they can look at your record. You know, it's sort of an interesting thing when you step back and look at both of these, is these were sort of signature pieces of legislation for the new wave of Democrats who came in the 2018 elections in Albany and shepherded through a whole list of progressive issues. And now it's sort of, here we are in February of 2020, and they're having headaches a little bit right now with two signature pieces, the bail reform and the so-called green light law, which allowed people who are in the country illegally to obtain a driver's license.
Yeah, all right. Well, that is where we're going to have to leave it. The DHS acting secretary after that meeting said no resolution, but we're going to continue. Talks are ongoing, as they say. So that's great. Thanks very much for the good analysis to Bernadette Hogan of the New York Post and Yancey Roy of Newsday.
To learn more about what we covered on tonight's show, head over to New York Now's website at nynow.org and follow us on social media at nynow_PBS. Until then, I'm Dan Clark. Thanks for watching this week's New York Now. Have a great week and be well.